Pauline! I looked at her incredulously. She turned back to arranging piles of bush beans.
Oh, stop acting so innocent, Leah. You know you find them both attractive. Who wouldn't?
I sighed. Who wouldn't indeed? But there was more to how I felt than simple attraction. I spilled sorrel, rose hips, dandelions, and loquats onto the platters surrounding the pigeons in a colorful, edible nest. And even though I didn't respond, Gwyneth and Pauline continued to go back and forth on the merits of Rafe and Caden and how I should proceed with them. I'm glad my friendships provide so much entertainment for you two. Gwyneth balked. Friendships? Ha! But a sure way to get the attentions of one is to lavish yours on another. Enough, I said. Birdie poked her head through the swinging door. Ready? She asked. Each of us took a platter into the dining room, which Birdie had lit with candles. She had pushed four tables together to create one large one in the center of the room. The guests were already seated around it. Caden, Rafe, and three others from the inn. The rest had gone to the public meal. We set the trays in the center of the table, and Pauline and Gwyneth quickly took the remaining open seats, leaving me to sit with Caden on my left and Rafe adjacent at the corner on my right. He smiled as I sat, and my frustrations melted into something else, something warm and expectant. Birdie took her place at the head of the table and sang the remembrances. The rest of us joined in, but I noticed Rafe only moved his lips. He didn't know the words. Had he received no instruction at all? It was the commonest of prayers. Every child knew it. I glanced at Pauline, sitting on the other side of Caden. She had noticed, too. But Caden sang even and clear. He was schooled in the holy songs. The songs were finished, and Birdie gave thanks for each item on the platters, all the foods that the remnant had found in abundance when they were delivered to a new land. And once each food was blessed, we were all invited to eat. The room went from reverent whispers to festive chatter. The meal was eaten with fingers only, following tradition, but Birdie did break with custom by bringing out one of her blackberry wines and pouring everyone a small glass. I sipped the dark purple liquid and felt its sweetness warm my chest. I turned to Rafe, who was watching me. I boldly looked back as I slowly nibbled a piece of the silky dark pigeon meat and then leisurely licked my greasy fingers, never taking my eyes from him. Rafe swallowed, though he hadn't eaten anything yet. He scooped up a handful of pine nuts and leaned back to pop them in his mouth. One fell from his hand to the table, and I reached out and put it in my mouth. I blinked slowly, pulling out every trick I had seen Gwyneth use, and then some. He took another sip of wine and pulled on his collar, his chest rising in a deep breath. And then suddenly, the icy curtain fell again. He looked away and began a conversation with Birdie. My resentment surged. Maybe I didn't know how to flirt. Or maybe I was just flirting with the wrong person. I looked at Gwyneth across from me. She tilted her head toward Caden. I turned and engaged him in chatter. We talked about the procession, the sacraments, and the games that would begin tomorrow. I noticed our earnest attention to each other set Rafe on edge. His own conversation with Birdie became stilted, and his fingers tapped on the table. I leaned closer to Caden and asked which games he would participate in tomorrow. I'm not really sure. His eyes narrowed, a question lurking behind them. He glanced at my hand resting on the table in front of him, invading his space, and he leaned closer. Is there one I should try? I've heard a lot of excitement about the log wrestling, but maybe you shouldn't. I reached up and laid my hand on his shoulder. How's your shoulder since I bandaged it? Rafe turned his head toward us, halting his conversation with Birdie. My shoulder is fine, Caden answered. You nursed it well. Rafe pushed back his chair. Thank you, Birdie, for... Fire shot through my temples. I knew what he was doing. One of his quick, cold exits. I cut him off, jumping up before he could, and threw my napkin on the table. I'm not so hungry after all. Excuse me. Caden tried to get up to follow, but Pauline grabbed his arm and pulled him back down.
You can't leave yet, Caden. I wanted to ask you...
I didn't hear the rest of her words. I was already out the door, charging for our cottage, humiliated, my frustrations doubling back in searing fury. I heard Rafe on my heels.
Leah, where are you going?
A bath, I yelled. I need a good cold bath.
It was rude of you to leave dinner, so...
I stopped and spun toward him, my rage so complete it was fortunate I didn't have my knife strapped to my side.
Go away! Do you understand me? Go away now!
I whirled back, not waiting to see if he listened or not. My head throbbed. My nails dug into my palms. When I reached the cottage, I threw open the door. I grabbed soap and a towel from the wardrobe, whirled around, and slammed into Rafe. I stepped back.
What's the matter with you? You say one thing to me with your eyes and another with your actions. Every time I think we've connected, you stomp off. Every time I want to...
I fought back tears. My throat tightened.
Am I that repulsive to you?
He stared at me, not answering, even though I stood there waiting for something. And I was struck with the horror of the truth. His jaw clenched. The silence was long and cruel. I wanted to die. His eyes were cold and accusing.
It's not as simple as...
I couldn't stand any more of his evasive platitudes.
Go! I yelled. Please go away! Permanently!
I pushed past him and took pleasure watching him stumble against the bed rail. I charged on toward the creek. I heard noises, half scream, half animal growl, foreign even to my ears, though they were coming from my own throat. He still followed. I turned on the trail to face him, spitting out my words.
Why in the gods' names are you tormenting me? What do you care that I left? You started to leave first.
His chest heaved, but his words cut, icy and even.
I was only leaving because you looked like you were occupied. Are you planning to take Caden as another lover?
He may as well have punched me in the gut. My breath was so completely taken away. I looked at him, my mouth open, still trying to comprehend his words.
Another lover?
I saw you,
he said, his eyes piercing me.
Your tryst in the woods. I think you called him Walther.
It took several seconds for me to even understand what he was talking about. When I finally did, a blinding black cloud whirled behind my eyes.
You stupid, stupid oaf! I screeched. Walther is my brother!
I shoved him with the flats of both hands, and he reeled back. I fled toward the creek. This time, there were no footsteps behind me. No demands that I stop. Nothing. I felt ill, as if the greasy pigeon was batting its way back up from my stomach. A lover. He'd said it with complete contempt. Had he been spying on me? Did he see what he wanted to see and nothing else? What had he expected of me? I retraced every step of my reunion with Walther, wondering how it could have been misconstrued. It couldn't, unless you were looking for something unseemly. I had run to Walther. I called his name. I hugged him, kissed his cheeks, laughed and whirled in joy with him, and that was all. Except that it was a secretive meeting, deep in the woods. When I reached the creek, I planted myself on a boulder and rubbed my ankle. It throbbed from my careless stomping. What had I done? My throat twisted into a painful knot. Rafe only saw me as a fickle, dallying maid who played with a multitude of in-guests. I closed my eyes and swallowed, trying to force the ache away. I would own up to my mistake, and I had made a perfectly glorious one. I had presumed too much. Rafe was a guest of the inn. I was a maid who worked there. And that was all. I thought of the terrible scene in the dining room, my shameless flirting with Caden, and everything I had said to Rafe. Heat flushed my face. How could I have made such a mistake? I slid from the rock to the ground, hugging my knees and staring at the creek. I had no interest in cold or hot baths anymore. I only wanted to crawl into a bed where I could sleep forever and pretend today had never happened. I thought about getting up, walking to the cottage, and melting into the mattress. But instead, my eyes stayed locked on the creek as I thought of Rafe, his face, his eyes, his warmth, his disdain, his vile presumptions. I had thought he was different. Everything about him seemed different, every way that he made me feel. I thought we had some sort of special connection. I was obviously so very wrong. The sparkling color of the creek dimmed to shadowy gray as daylight receded. I knew it was time to go before Pauline worried about where I was and came looking for me, but my legs were too tired to carry me. I heard a noise, a soft shuffling. I turned my head toward the path, wondering if Pauline had already hunted me down. But it wasn't her. It was Rafe. I closed my eyes and took a long, pained breath. Please leave. I couldn't deal with him anymore. I opened my eyes. He was still there. A bottle in one hand, a small basket in the other. He stood tall and still and so beautifully and irritatingly perfect. I looked at him blankly, betraying no emotion. Leave. He took a step closer. I shook my head, and he stopped. You were right, Leah, he said quietly. I remained silent. When we first met, you called me an ill-mannered boor. He shifted from one foot to the other, pausing to look at the ground, an awkward, worried expression crossing his face. He looked back up. I'm everything you could ever call me, and more, including stupid oaf. Maybe especially that. He walked closer. I shook my head again, wanting him to stop. He didn't. I got to my feet, grimacing as I put weight on my ankle. Rafe, I said quietly, just go away. It's all a big mistake. Please, let me get this out while I still have the courage to say it. The troubled crease deepened between his brows. My life's complicated, Leah. There are so many things I can't explain to you. Things you wouldn't even want to know. But there's one thing you could never call me. He set the bottle and basket down on a patch of grass. The one thing you can never call me is repulsed by you. I swallowed. He closed what gap was left between us, and I had to lift my chin to see him. He looked down at me. Because ever since that first day I met you, I've gone to sleep every single night thinking about you, and every morning when I wake, my first thoughts are of you. He stepped impossibly closer and lifted his hands, cupping my face, his touch so gentle it was barely there. When I'm not with you,
I wonder where you are. I wonder what you're doing. I think about how much I want to touch you. I want to feel your skin, your hair, run every dark strand through my fingers. I want to hold you, your hands, your chin. His face drew nearer, and I felt his breath on my skin. I want to pull you close and never let you go, he whispered. We stood there, every second an eternity, and slowly our lips met, warm, gentle, his mouth soft against mine, his breath becoming mine. And then, just as slowly, the perfect moment paused, and our lips parted again. He pulled back far enough to look at me, his hand sliding from my face to my hair, his fingers tangling in it. My own hands reached up, slipping behind his head. I pulled him to me, our lips scarcely touching, taking the tingle and warmth of each other in, and then our mouths pressed together again.
Leah?
We heard Pauline's distant, worried call and moved away from each other. I wiped my lips, adjusting my shirt, and saw her coming around the path. Rafe and I stood like awkward wooden soldiers. Pauline stopped short when she saw us.
I'm sorry. It was getting dark, and when I didn't find you in the cottage...
We were just walking back, Rafe answered.
We looked at each other, and he sent me a message with his eyes. It only lasted a brief second, but it was a full, knowing look that said everything I had felt and imagined about us was true. He stooped and grabbed the basket and bottle, handing them to me.
I thought your appetite might return.
I nodded. Yes. It seemed it already had.
Chapter 32.
I leaned forward in the tub as Pauline scrubbed my back, savoring the slippery luxury of the bath oils on my skin and the hot water soothing my bruised muscles. Pauline dropped the sponge in the water in front of me, splashing my face.
Come back to Earth, Leah, she called.
It's not every day one has a first kiss, I said.
May I remind you that it wasn't your first kiss?
It felt like it was. It was the first one that mattered. She had told me as we were drawing water for our baths that everyone could hear us yelling from the dining room, so Bertie and Gwyneth had started another round of songs to drown out our words. But Pauline had heard me shout, "Go away," so she never thought she'd end up interrupting a kiss. She'd already apologized several times, but I told her that nothing could take away from the moment. She lifted a pitcher of warm rose water.
Now?
I stood, and she let the fragrant water trickle over my head and down my body into the tub. I wrapped myself in a towel and stepped out, still reliving every moment, especially that last brief exchange looking into each other's eyes. A farmer, I sighed. Isn't that romantic?
Yes, Pauline agreed.
So much more genuine than a stuffy old prince. I smiled. He worked the land. He made things grow. Pauline, when did you... And then I remembered it wasn't a subject I should broach with her.
When did I what?
I shook my head. Nothing. She sat on the end of the bed, rubbing oil onto her freshly bathed ankles. She appeared to have forgotten my half-said question, but after a moment she asked,
"When did I know I had fallen in love with Mikhail?"
I sat down across from her. "Yes." She sighed, pulling her knees up and hugging them.
"It was early spring. I had seen Mikhail several times in the village. He always had plenty of girls around him, so I never thought he'd noticed me. But he had. One day, as I walked by, I felt his gaze on me, even though I didn't look his way. Every time I went by after that, he stopped, ignoring the attentions of those around him, and he watched me until I passed, and then one day... I watched her eyes looking at the opposite wall, but seeing something else. Seeing Mikhail. I was on my way to the dressmaker, and he suddenly fell in step beside me. I was so nervous I just looked straight ahead. He didn't say anything, just walked beside me. And when we were almost at the shop, he said, "I'm Mikhail." I started to reply, and he stopped me. He said, "You don't have to tell me who you are. I already know. You're the most exquisite creature the gods ever created." "And that's when you knew you loved him?" She laughed. "Oh, no! What soldier doesn't have a posy of sweet words at the ready?" She sighed and shook her head. "No, it was 2 weeks later, when he'd exhausted every posy at his disposal, and he seemed so dejected. And he looked at me. Just looked at me." Her eyes glistened. "And then he whispered my name in the sweetest, weakest, most honest voice. Pauline. That's all. Just my name. Pauline. That's when I knew. He had nothing left. But he wasn't giving up." She smiled, her expression dreamy, and resumed massaging oil into her foot and ankle. Was it possible that Pauline and Mikhail had shared something true and real? Or had Mikhail just drawn from a new well of tricks? Whichever it was, he had gone back to his old ways and warmed his lap now with a fresh supply of girls, forgetting Pauline and tossing aside whatever they had. But that didn't make her love for him any less true. I bent over and rubbed my hair with the towel to dry it. "I want to feel your skin, your hair, run every dark strand through my fingers." I pulled the wet strands to my nose and sniffed. Did he like the scent of rose? My first encounter with Wraith had been a contentious one, and not by any stretch had I been smitten the way Walther was when he saw Greta. And Wraith certainly hadn't wooed me with sweet words the way Mikhail had Pauline. But maybe that didn't make it any less true. Maybe there were 100 different ways to fall in love.
From the loins of Morrigan, from the far end of desolation, from the scheming of rulers, from the fears of a queen, hope will be born. Song of Venda. Chapter 33.
I nearly burst with joy watching Pauline dress in the new clothes I'd bought her, a loose peach-colored shift and delicate green sandals. After weeks of wearing the heavy clothing of Civica or her drab morning clothes, she blossomed in the summer hues. "Such a relief in this heat! I couldn't love it more, Leah," she said, admiring the transformation in the mirror. She turned sideways, pulling on the fabric to judge its girth. "And it should fit me through the last spike of autumn." I placed the garland of pink flowers on her head, and she became a magical wood nymph. "Your turn," she said. My own shift was white with embroidered lavender flowers sprinkled across it. I slipped it on and twirled, looking at myself in the mirror and feeling something akin to a cloud, light and liberated from this earth. Pauline and I both paused, contemplating the claw and vine on my shoulder, the thin straps of the shift leaving it clearly visible. Pauline reached out, touched the claw, and shook her head slowly as she considered it. "It suits you, Leah. I'm not sure why, but it does." When we arrived at the tavern, Rafe and Caden were loading the wagon with tables from the dining room and cases of Bertie's blackberry wine and preserves. As we approached, they both stopped mid-lift and slowly set their heavy loads back down. They said nothing, just stared.
"We should bathe more often,"
I whispered to Pauline, and we both suppressed a giggle. We excused ourselves to go inside and see if Bertie needed help with anything else. We found her with Gwyneth in the kitchen, loading pastries into a basket. Pauline stared longingly at the golden-crusted blackberry scones as they disappeared layer after layer into the basket. Bertie finally offered her one. She nibbled a corner self-consciously and swallowed.
"There's something I need to tell you all," she blurted out breathlessly.
For a moment, chatter, shuffling, and clinking of pans stopped. Everyone stared at Pauline. Bertie set the scone she was about to add to the basket back on the tray.
"We know," she said.
"No," Pauline insisted. "You don't. I..."
Gwyneth reached out and grabbed Pauline's arms.
"We know."
Somehow this became the signal for all four of us to go to the table in the corner of the kitchen and sit. Gentle folds pressed down around Bertie's eyelids, her lower lids watery, as she explained that she had been waiting for Pauline to tell her. Gwyneth nodded her understanding while I looked at all of them in wonder. Their words were sure and deliberate. Hands were squeezed, days counted, and sorrows shouldered. My hands reaching out to become part of it all. The agreement, the solidarity. Pauline's head pulled to Bertie's chest. Gwyneth and I exchanging glances. So much said with no words at all. Our relationships shifted. We became a sisterhood with a common cause. Soldiers of our own elite guard, promising to get through this together. All of us pledging to help Pauline. And all in the space of 20 minutes before there was a tap at the kitchen door. The wagon was loaded. We went back to our duties with Pauline buoyed among us. If I'd felt like a cloud before, now I was like a planet winking from the heavens. A burden shared wasn't so heavy to bear anymore. Seeing Pauline's lighter steps made mine glide above the ground. Bertie and Pauline left to load the remaining baskets, and Gwyneth and I said we would follow after we'd swept the floor and wiped the crumbs from the counters. We knew it was better to deter furry gray visitors now than watch Bertie chase them with a broom later. It was a small task that was quickly done, and when I had the kitchen door halfway open to leave, Gwyneth stopped me.
"Can we talk?"
Her tone had changed from only minutes earlier when our conversation flowed as easily as warm syrup. Now I heard a prickly edge. I closed the door, my back still to her, and braced myself.
"I've heard some news," she said.
I turned to face her and smiled, refusing to let her serious expression alarm me. "We hear news every day, Gwyneth. You need to give me more than that." She folded a towel and laid it neatly across the counter, smoothing it, avoiding eye contact with me.
"There's a rumor. No, very close to a fact. That Venda has sent an assassin to find you."
"To find me?"
She looked up. "To kill you."
I tried to laugh, shake it off, but all I managed was a stiff grin. Why would Venda go to such trouble? I don't lead an army, and everyone knows that I don't have the gift.
She bit her lip. "Everyone doesn't know that. In fact, rumors are growing that your gift is strong, and that's how you managed to elude the king's best trackers."
I paced, looking up at the ceiling. How I hated rumors. I stopped and faced her. "I eluded them with the aid of some very strategic help, and the truth be known, the king was lazy in his efforts to find me." I shrugged.
"But people will believe what they choose to believe."
"Yes, they will," she answered.
And right now, Venda believes you're a threat. That's all that matters. They don't want there to be a second chance of an alliance. Venda knows that Dalbrecht doesn't trust Morrigan. They never have. The ferrying of the king's first daughter was crucial to an alliance between them. It was a significant step toward trust. That trust is destroyed now. Venda wants to keep it that way. I tried to keep suspicion from my voice, but as she related each detail, I felt my wariness grow.
And how would you know all this, Gwyneth?
Surely the usual patrons at the tavern haven't spilled such rumors. How I came by it isn't important. It is to me. She looked down at her hands resting on the towel, smoothed a wrinkle, then met my gaze again. Let's just say that my methods loom large among my regrettable mistakes. But occasionally I can make them useful.
I stared at her. Just when I thought I had Gwyneth figured out, another side of her came to light.
I shook my head, sorting out my thoughts.
Bertie didn't tell you who I was just because you live in town, did she?
No. But I promise you how I know is no concern of yours.
It is my concern, I said, folding my arms across my chest.
She looked away, exasperated, her eyes flashing with anger, and then back again. She breathed out a long huff of air, shaking her head. She seemed to be battling her regrettable mistakes right before me.
There are spies everywhere, Leah, she finally blurted out. In every sizable town and hamlet. It might be the butcher. It might be the fishmonger. One palm crosses another in return for watchful eyes. I was one of them.
You're a spy?
Was. We all do what we have to do to survive.
Her manner jumped from defensive to earnest.
I'm not part of that world anymore. I haven't been for years, not since I came to work for Bertie. Terravin is a sleepy town and no one cares much about what happens here, but I still hear things. I still have acquaintances who sometimes pass through.
Connections.
That's right. The eyes of the realm, they call it.
And it all filters back to Civica?
Where else?
I nodded, taking a deep breath. The eyes of the realm?
Suddenly I was far less concerned with a grunting barbarian assassin combing the wilderness for me than with Gwyneth, who seemed to lead multiple lives.
I'm on your side, Leah, she said, as if she could read my mind. Remember that. I'm only telling you this so you'll be careful. Be aware.
Was she really on my side?
She had been a spy.
But she didn't have to tell me any of this. And ever since I arrived, she had been kind. On the other hand, more than once she had suggested that I return to Civica and live up to my responsibilities. Duty. Tradition. She didn't believe I belonged here. Was she trying to scare me away now?
They're only rumors, Gwyneth. Probably conjured in taverns like our own from lack of entertainment. A tight smile lifted the corners of her mouth, and she nodded stiffly.
You're probably right. I just thought you should know.
And now I do. Let's go.
Bertie had gone ahead in the wagon with Wraith and Caden to set up the tables. Gwyneth, Pauline, and I walked to town at a leisurely pace, taking in the festive transformation of Terravin. The storefronts and homes, already glorious in their bright palettes alone, were now magical confectionery decorated with colorful garlands and ribbons. My conversation with Gwyneth couldn't dampen my spirits. Indeed, it oddly elevated them. My resolve was cemented. I would never go back. I did belong here. I had more reasons now than ever to stay.
We arrived at the plaza, full of townsfolk and merchants spreading their tables with their specialties.
It was a day of sharing. No coin would be traded. The smell of roasted boar cooking in a covered pit dug near the plaza filled the air, and just past that, whole slinky lamprey and red peppers sizzled on grills. We spotted Bertie setting up her tables in a far corner, throwing out gaily colored tablecloths to cover them. Rafe carried one of the cases from the wagon and set it on the ground beside her, and Caden followed with two baskets.
"It went well for you last night?" Gwyneth asked.
"Yes, it went very well," Pauline answered for me.
My own answer to Gwyneth was simply a wicked smile. By the time I reached Bertie, I had lost Pauline to a table of hot griddle cakes and Gwyneth to Simone, who had called to her from a miniature pony she rode upon.
"Don't need you here," Bertie said, shooing me away as I approached. "Go, have fun. I'm going to sit here in the shade and take it all in. I'll see to the tables."
Rafe was just returning from the wagon with another case. I tried not to stare, but with his sleeves rolled up and his tan forearms flexing under the weight, I couldn't look away. I imagined his work as a farmhand that kept him fit, digging trenches, plowing fields, harvesting... what? Barley? Melon? Other than the small citadel garden, the only fields I had experience with were the vast Morrigan vineyards. My brothers and I always visited them in early autumn before harvest. They were magnificent, and the vines produced the most highly prized vintages on the continent. The lesser kingdoms paid enormous sums for a single barrel. In all my many visits to the vineyards, though, I had never seen a farmhand like Rafe. If I had, I certainly would have taken a more active interest in the vines. He stopped next to Bertie, setting his case down.
"Morning again," he said, sounding short of breath.
I smiled. "You've already put in a day's work." His eyes traveled over me, beginning at the garland on my head that he had taken some pains to hunt down, to my decidedly new and slight attire. He glanced at Bertie sitting on a crate beside him. He cleared his throat.
"You slept well?"
I nodded, grinning.
"What now?" he asked.
Caden came up behind Rafe, bumping into him as he set a chair down for Bertie.
"The log wrestling, right? That's what Leah said everyone is the most excited about."
He adjusted the chair to Bertie's liking and stood tall, stretching his arms overhead, as if the morning of fetching and hauling had been just a little warm-up. He patted Rafe's shoulder.
"Unless you're not up to it. Can I walk you, Leah?"
Bertie rolled her eyes, leaving me to squirm. Had I created this quagmire when I flirted with Caden last night? Probably, just like everyone else, he'd heard me yelling at Rafe to go away, but he evidently hadn't heard anything else.
"Yes," I said. "Let's all walk together, shall we?"
A scowl crossed Rafe's face, but his voice was cheerful.
"I'm all for a good game, Caden, and I think you could use a sound dunking. Let's go."
It wasn't exactly a dunking. Once we wove through the crowd, we saw a log that was suspended by ropes, only the log wasn't suspended over water, as I had assumed, but over a deep puddle of thick, black mud.
"Still up for it?" Caden asked.
"I won't be the one falling in," Rafe replied.
We watched two men wrestle atop the log while the crowd cheered valiantly at every push and lunge. Everyone gasped collectively when both men teetered, arms swinging to regain balance, lunged again, and finally fell together face first. They came up looking like they'd been dipped in chocolate batter. The crowd laughed and roared their approval as the men trudged out of the muck, wiping their faces and spitting out mud. Two new contestants were called. One was Rafe. Rafe's brows shot up in surprise. Apparently they were calling them in random order.
We had expected him and Caden to be paired. Rafe unbuttoned his shirt, pulled it loose from his trousers, and took it off, handing it to me. I blinked, trying not to stare at his bare chest.
"Expecting to fall?" Caden asked. "I don't want it to get spattered when my opponent plummets."
The crowd cheered as Rafe and the other contestant, a tall fellow of muscular build, climbed the ladders to the log. The game master explained the rules. No fists, no biting, no stomping on fingers or feet, but everything else was fair play. He blew a horn, and the bout began. They moved slowly at first, sizing each other up. I chewed my lip. Rafe didn't even want to do this. He was a farmer, a flatlander, not a wrestler, and he'd been goaded into the contest by Caden. His opponent made a move, springing at Rafe, but Rafe expertly blocked him and grabbed the man's right forearm, twisting it so that his balance was uneven. The man swayed for a moment, and the crowd shouted, thinking the match was over, but the man broke free, stumbled back, and regained his footing. Rafe didn't give him more time than that and advanced, ducking low and swiping behind the man's knee. It was over. The man's arms flailed back awkwardly like a pelican trying to take flight. He tumbled through the air as Rafe looked on with his hands on his hips. Mud sprayed up, dotting the lower part of Rafe's trousers. He smiled and took a deep bow for the crowd. They howled in admiration, with extra cheers for his theatrics. He turned toward us, gave me a nod, and with a captivating but smug grin, lifted his palms to Caden and shrugged like it was short, easy work. The mob cheered. Rafe started to climb back down the ladder, but the game master stopped him and called the next contestant. Apparently, Rafe's crowd-pleasing antics had won him another round on the log. He shrugged and waited for the next contestant to approach the ladder. There was a hush as he came forward. I recognized him. He was the farrier's son, 16 at the most, but a stout boy, easily having 100 pounds on Rafe, if not more. Would the ladder hold him? I remembered he was a boy of few words, but focused on his tasks when he'd come with his father to replace a shoe on Dieci. He looked just as focused now as he climbed the ladder. A puzzled frown crossed Rafe's face. This new opponent was 2 heads shorter than he was. The boy stepped out on the log and came to meet Rafe, his steps slow and cautious, but his balance as solid as lead. Rafe reached out and pushed his shoulders, probably thinking that would be the end of it. The boy didn't budge. He seemed to become one with the wood, a stump growing from a log. Rafe grabbed his arms, and the boy wrestled mildly with him, but his strength was in his low center of gravity, and he leaned neither one way nor the other. Rafe came closer, pushing, wrangling, twisting, but stumps don't twist easily. I could see the sweat glistening on Rafe's chest. He finally let go, stepped back, shook his head like he was done, then lunged, grabbing the boy's arms and yanking him forward. The stump broke loose from his position, and Rafe fell back, grabbing the log to keep from going down. The boy toppled forward, bouncing on his stomach, and his arms scrabbled for a hold as he slid to the side. Rafe jumped back to his feet and leaned down to the boy, who was still desperately trying to secure his grip.
"Safe travels, my friend," Rafe said, smiling as he gently nudged the boy's shoulder.
That was all it took. The boy lost his hold and fell like a rock into the mud. This time the spray flew higher, spattering Rafe's chest. He rubbed the drops of mud in with his sweat and grinned. The crowd went wild, and a few girls standing near me whispered among themselves. I thought it was time for him to put his shirt back on.
"Caden!" the game master called.
Rafe had already wrestled up there long enough. but I knew he wouldn't back down now. Caden smiled and climbed up with his crisp white shirt still on. It was clear as soon as Caden stepped out on the log that this match would be different from the others. The tension between the two heightened the awareness of the crowd and quieted them down. Caden and Rafe moved toward each other slowly, both crouched for balance, arms poised at their sides. Then, with lightning speed, Caden stepped forward and swung his leg. Rafe jumped straight in the air, clearing Caden's leg and landing with perfect grace back on the log. He lunged, grabbing Caden's arms, and they both teetered. I could hardly watch as they battled to regain their footing, and then, using each other as counterweight, they swung around, ending up on opposite sides from where they'd started. Riotous cheers broke the breathless silence. Neither Rafe nor Caden seemed to hear the frenzy around them. Rafe sprang forward again, but Caden skillfully retreated several paces so that Rafe lost his momentum and stumbled. Then Caden advanced, plowing into him. Rafe staggered back, his feet scrambling for purchase, and the battle between them raged on, each struggling to keep his own footing while working to unbalance the other. I wasn't sure how much more I could watch. When their wrestling brought their faces within inches of each other, I saw their lips moving. I couldn't hear what was said, but Rafe glared, and a sneer twisted Caden's lips. With a surge of energy and a shout that resembled a battle cry, Caden pushed forward, wrenching Rafe to one side. Rafe fell, but managed to grab the log. He hung precariously by his hands. All Caden had to do was nudge his fingers loose. Instead, he stood over him and said loudly, "Concede, my friend?" "When I'm in hell," Rafe grunted, the strain of hanging muffling his words. Caden looked from Rafe to me. I'm not sure what he saw in my face, but he turned back to Rafe, staring at him for a few long seconds, and then stepped back, giving Rafe plenty of room.
"Swing up. Let's end this properly. I want to see your face in the mud, not just your breeches."
Even from where I stood, I could see sweat trickling down Rafe's face. Why didn't he just drop? If he landed right, he'd only be up to his knees in mud. I watched him take a deep breath and swing his legs up, hooking one over the log. He struggled to the top. Caden stayed back, giving Rafe time to regain his footing. How long could this go on? The crowd was cheering, shouting, applauding, and the gods knew what else. It all melted into a distant roar for me. Rafe's skin glistened. He had been in the blazing sun through three opponents now. He wiped his upper lip with the back of his hand, and they advanced toward each other again. Caden gained the upper hand one moment, and Rafe the next. Finally, they both seemed to lean against each other, catching their breath.
"Concede?" Caden asked again.
"In hell," Rafe repeated. They pushed apart, but as Rafe glanced back toward me, Caden made his move, a last burst, his legs swinging wide, knocking Rafe clear of the log and into the air. Caden landed on his stomach, clinging to the log as Rafe emerged from the mud below him. Rafe wiped the muck from his face and looked up.
"Concede?" Caden asked.
Rafe saluted, graciously giving Caden his due, but then smiled.
"In hell."
The crowd roared with laughter, and I took a deep breath, relieved that it was finally over. At least I hoped it was over. I wove my way through the crowd to meet them as they left the arena. Though Caden had officially won the bout, Rafe took great pleasure in pointing out the mud sprayed across Caden's shirt.
"I guess you should have taken it off after all," he said.
"So I should have," Caden answered. "But I hadn't expected such a spectacular fall from you."
They both left to go back to the inn to bathe and change, promising to return soon. As I watched them walk off together, I hoped that would be the end of the dirty games.
Chapter 34.
I meandered down the main avenue alone, taking in the other events, comparing it all to the way it was done in Civica. Some things were unique to Terravin, like catching live fish barehanded in the plaza fountain, but all the games had their roots in the survival of the chosen remnant. Though Morrigan had eventually led them to a new land of abundance, the trek wasn't easy. Many died, and only the most resourceful made it through, so the games were rooted in those survival skills, like catching fish when opportunity availed, but a hook and line didn't. I came upon a large roped-off field with a variety of obstacles set within, mostly wooden barrels and a wagon or two. It commemorated Morrigan leading the remnant through a blind pass when they had to rely on their faith in her gift. Contestants were blindfolded and spun, then had to make their way from one end of the field to the other. It had been one of my favorite events back in Civica from the time I was very young. I had always beaten my brothers, to the delight of everyone watching, except perhaps my mother. I was making my way toward the contestant line when someone stepped into my path and I slammed into a chest.
"Well, if it isn't the haughty, smart-mouthed tavern girl!"
I stumbled back several steps, stunned, and looked up. It was the soldier I had chastised weeks ago. It appeared the sting of my words was still fresh. He swaggered closer, prepared to deliver my comeuppance. My disgust was renewed. A soldier in my father's own army. For the first time since leaving Civica, I wanted to reveal who I was, reveal it loudly and boldly and watch him pale, use my position to put him in his place once and for all. But I no longer had that position, nor was I willing to sacrifice my new life for the likes of him. He stepped closer. "If you seek to intimidate me," I said, holding my ground, "I'll warn you right now that belly-crawling vermin don't frighten me."
"You nasty little—"
His hand shot up to strike me, but I was faster. He stopped, staring at the knife already drawn in my hand. "If you were so foolish as to lay one of your lecherous fingers on me, I fear we'd both regret it. It would ruin the festivities for everyone here, because I'd slice away at the nearest thing to me, no matter how small." I looked directly at his crotch, then turned the knife in my hands as if I was inspecting it. Our encounter could turn into an ugly affair. His face seethed with fury. It only empowered me more. "But don't fear," I said, lifting my hem and returning my knife to the sheath secured at my thigh. "I'm sure our paths will cross again, and our differences will be settled once and for all. Walk carefully, because next time it will be I who will surprise you." My words were reckless and impulsive, driven by loathing and fanned by the safety of hundreds of people around us. But reckless or not, it felt as right and fitting as a snug boot delivered to his backside. Surprisingly, his rage curled to a smile.
"Till we meet again, then."
He nodded a slow, deliberate goodbye and brushed past me. I watched him walk away, fingering the comfort of my dagger beneath my shift. Even if my arms were pinned to my sides, I could reach it now. And on my thigh it was more easily concealed, at least in a thin summer dress. He disappeared into the crowds. I could only hope he'd be called up soon to return to his regiment, and if the gods be just, kicked in the head by a horse. I didn't know his name, but I'd talk to Walther about him. Maybe he could do something about a snake in his ranks. In spite of his smile, which I knew foretold an unpleasant outcome should we meet again. I was invigorated. Some things needed to be said. I smiled at my own boldness and went to try my luck with a blindfold and tamer obstacles. The bell of the sacrista rang once, noting the half hour. Rafe and Caden would be back shortly, but there was something I still needed to attend to, and today might afford the best opportunity. I walked up the front steps of the sanctuary. Children chased each other around the stone columns, and mothers sought shade in the portico, but after yesterday's long day of prayers, few were inside, just as I had hoped. I went through the motions, sitting on a rear bench until my eyes adjusted to the dim light and I could assess who was present. An elderly man sat in the front row. Two elderly women sat shoulder to shoulder in the middle, and kneeling on the chancel, a cantor chanted the graces of the gods. That was it. Even the priests seemed to be outside partaking in the festivities. I made the necessary signs of remembrance, stepped quietly to the back, and slipped up the dark stairwell. All sacristas had archives shelving the texts of Morrigan and the other kingdoms. The priests were scholars as much as servants to the gods. But foreign texts, by rule of the kingdom, were not to be shared with the citizenry unless approved first by the scholars of Civica, who verified the text's authenticity and assessed their value. The royal scholar oversaw them all. The stairs were narrow and steep. My hand slid along the stone wall as I slowly ascended. I listened for noises. I carefully emerged into a long vestibule, and the silence assured me that the sacristy was largely unattended. There were several draped doorways, their heavy fabric pulled aside to reveal empty chambers. But at the end of the hallway was a wide double door. There. I walked directly to it. The room was large and amply stocked. The collection wasn't as extensive as the scholars in Civica, but it was sizable enough to take some time to search. There were no carpets or rich velvet drapes here to muffle sound, so I had to move stools quietly to reach the higher shelves. I'd been through nearly all of them, finding nothing that would prove useful, when at last I pulled a tiny volume from an upper shelf. The whole book wasn't much bigger than a man's palm. Venden Phrases and Usage. Perhaps it was a priest's guide to delivering death blessings to the barbarians? I slid the other books together to hide the small gap the book had left, and looked through a few pages. It might prove useful to help me decipher the Venden book I stole from the scholar, but I'd have to explore it further somewhere else. I hiked up my shift and slid it into my underclothing, a safe, if uncomfortable, place to hide it until I was at least out of the sacrista. I lowered my shift and smoothed it back in place.
"I would have given it to you, Arabella. There was no need to steal it."
I froze, my back to my unexpected company, and contemplated my next move. Still atop the stool, I turned slowly to see a priest standing in the doorway, the one who had watched me yesterday. "I must be losing my touch," I said. "I used to be able to slip into a room, pilfer what I wanted, and steal away again with no one the wiser." He nodded.
"When we don't use our gifts, they leave us."
The word gifts settled on me heavily, no doubt the way he intended it to. I lifted my chin. "Some gifts were never mine to lose."
"Then you're called to use the ones that you do possess."
"You know me?" He smiled.
"I could never forget you. I was a young priest, one of the 12 who delivered the sacraments of your dedication. You wailed like a stuck pig."
Maybe even as an infant I knew where that dedication would lead me.
"There's no question in my mind. You knew."
I looked at him. His black hair was tinged with gray at the temples, but he was still a young man by ancient priest standards, vigorous and engaged. He wore the required black vestments and long white cape, but he hardly seemed like a priest.